So good morning, everybody. Good morning. My name's Jane Blaisby. I'm an academic surgeon from Bristol. And it's really with great pleasure that I welcome you here this morning to this meeting, which is going to be looking at recruitment issues in randomized controlled trials in surgery. Dion Morton and I, where's Dion over there? We're really pleased that you're all here, because about 6 months ago, we sat down in a meeting and we talked about this, and Dion said, Jane, nobody will come to your meeting. And I thought, oh, don't expect they will. And I started thinking of all these people I knew, and I was going to write them crawling emails and saying, please, can you come, and all that. And he kept saying, no, they won't come. And finally, we wrote a program, and we put it up and invited you all. And within 2 weeks, we had 200 people, and it was full. We also spent some money and advertised it in the Association of Surgeons in those handbooks that you get when you go to a meeting. So an extra 5,000 people were invited, by which time the meeting was full, so it's very embarrassing. And then finally, we ended up with about 270 people and a long waiting list. So we're really, really pleased you're here. And also, I'm particularly pleased that about a third of you are surgeons, about a third of you are methodologists and trialists, and the other third are a mixture of patients, service users, managers, research people that organise things. And so, and that's just what we need for trials. We need that multidisciplinary approach, so that's great that you're here. Thank you very much for coming. So this meeting is supported by the MRC, the Medical Research Council Hubs, Trials Methodology Hubs. About 3 years ago, the MRC invested £16 million into hubs, trials methodology hubs. And the purpose of the hubs is to work out better ways of doing randomised trials. That's their main purpose. They also have a role in terms of providing training and infrastructure for trials, for clinical trials units and for research design services. And there are 8 hubs across the country, one in Edinburgh, one in Liverpool, Birmingham, Oxford, Cambridge, London, Bristol, and one in Northern Ireland. And the way to think of the hubs, if you haven't heard them, get in touch with your local hub. They're a bit like tertiary referral centres. So if you think about it, at the first level, you want to do some research, go and talk to the RDS, go and talk to the research design service. If you're going to design a clinical trial, go and talk to a clinical trials unit. They're the sort of secondary care. But the more complex specialist level is a bit like the hubs, where we have a sort of tertiary referral role to try and work out better ways of doing trials and to support the clinical trials units. And the Cambridge hub, the biostatistics hub, and the Bristol hub are the two hubs that are involved in this meeting. So Linda Sharples is here from the Cambridge hub. In addition to the hubs, there's what we call a hub network. And the purpose of the network is that hubs work together for added value, and this is why we have this meeting. And there's an opportunity for future meetings, and we really want your feedback about what a future meeting would look like in terms of further opportunities to look at surgical trials. We have some ideas, but please come and stop me or fill it in the feedback forms and tell us what you would like us to do next year. So recruitment, just before I hand over to the first speaker. Recruitment, it has been said that it's the biggest issue that faces clinical trials at the moment. Recruitment is the number one methodological challenge, and it's the biggest issue that faces clinical trialists. Possibly recruitment into surgical trials is more difficult than into pharmaceutical trials, probably is. But there are a number of other challenges in surgical trials that also make them difficult. We're going to hear this morning from leaders of trials, from surgeons and from methodologists about their experience on the coalface of recruiting into surgical trials, tips for success. One of the people talking this morning, their trial is recruited way beyond target. It's really streaking ahead. We want to hear how they've managed to achieve that. And we're really grateful to you all for speaking. And I'm going to start by handing over to Peter Hutchinson, the first speaker. Peter's a neurosurgeon from Addenbrookes, academic in the University of Cambridge, PI of a trial that you'll hear about, and PI of a trial that's been published in The Lancet last year, year before last, which is fantastic. So thank you very much, Pete.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much to Jane and Dion for the invitation to come and talk and share our experiences of running a surgical trial in the management of patients with severe head injury. I really want to focus the talk on the logistics of the trial, but I think it is important to give you some background. For those of you who are not aware, head injury, although it's very common, severe head injury is relatively minor, but it is the commonest cause of death under the age of 40, and there is severe disability in the survivors. Now, of patients with severe head injury, approximately 10% develop very severe swelling and rise in intracranial pressure. And the problem with that is it reduces blood flow, cerebral oxygenation, energy failure, and causes further swelling and this vicious cycle. Now, management of these patients is directed in intensive care at trying to control intracranial pressure. We measure it by putting a probe into the brain and like to keep it less than 25 millimeters of mercury. And there's a number of therapies that are available to try and control pressure. And really, there's little evidence for any of these therapies. But our particular interest is in what we call the heavy-duty therapy, barbiturate coma, or some form of surgery to control ICP. And that was really the focus for our study. Broadly speaking, if you look at surgery following head injury, patients who have an acute subdural hematoma that you can see here, the indication for craniotomy, removing the bone, taking the blood clot out, is well established. But what we're not clear about is whether there's any role for surgery in patients who have diffuse brain swelling without a focal blood clot. There is an operation that exists in these patients. It's been around many years. It's quite simple in theory in that a large part of the skull is removed, and that enables the scalp to be put back over the brain and the brain to swell under the scalp as a way of opening the tight box and lowering pressure. But although that operation's been performed on and off, it's been in and out of vogue over several years, nobody actually knows whether it's effective in improving outcome for patients. And if you look at the evidence, as in many of the surgical interventions, Cochrane have looked at it, they talk about it as a useful option. The Brain Trauma Foundation have looked at it, they again use the word option, and nobody really knows whether or when to apply this operation in this population of patients. So we thought, well, one way to try and answer the question is, could we actually set up a study where we randomise patients on intensive care to have ongoing medical treatment of their raised intracranial pressure on one arm of the study, or the other arm is actually to perform a decompressive craniectomy? And that study has been going for several years. We started the sort of concept in 2004, and really I'm going to share with you some of the experiences that we've had along the way. So the hypothesis for the study is that the application of decompressive craniectomy to head injured patients with raised and refractory ICP results in improvement in outcome compared to optimal medical management. So we've tried to put a fairly simple question, you know, brain swelling, high pressure, should we do an operation or not? So it's prospective randomized, it's powered at 400 patients. There was some question when we applied for definitive funding whether we should go for 600 patients, but subsequently the DMEC and the steering committee have settled on 400 patients. And it's, you know, simple in concept, patients on intensive care with raised pressure are randomized to a medical arm or a surgical arm, and then outcome is assessed at 6 months, 1 year and 2 years using a Glasgow outcome score and a quality of life questionnaire. So in terms of progress, you know, we started this off without any funding, put a research team together, devised the protocol, and I'll take you through these various stages. Although the study started in 2004, we didn't get definitive funding from the MRC until 2007, but that clearly made a tremendous difference. Received that funding, which has enabled us to maintain the team together, enables us to pay a small per patient fee for recruitment to other centres of £500. It's interesting, I was, we're talking multi-centre study and was talking to a guy at a GCP training session from Roche, and, you know, he was interested in the study and he assumed our budget would be around 20 or 30 million euros and was just astonished that we can do this sort of research for this sort of money. So the team is here. We have research fellows who have been consecutive. Firstly, Ivan Timofeev, and then Angius Cullius, and a research nurse, Liz Courtine. We have support from other academic people in Cambridge, including the foundation year doctors. We've had a lot of tremendous support from the University of Cambridge Research Services, particularly in dealing with the finances. And the R&D department in Addenbrookes have been particularly supportive, and Louis Stockley and Sam Barker from the R&D department are here today. Probably one of the most difficult things in terms of doing a multi-centre study is to settle on the protocol. People have quite strong ideas about how these patients should be managed, and we started off with a very didactic protocol about the doses of various drugs, which of the other interventions should be used. For example, hypothermia, but the Italians didn't want to use hypothermia, so they wouldn't join the study. So we've had to try and make the protocol flexible in that everybody can participate, but it still needs to be robust enough in order to answer the question. So some of these therapies are options, and the way we get around that is stratify the randomization by centre, so it equals out in terms of the options in the pre-randomization characteristics. So I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but in essence, if pressure is still high, patients are randomized into the medical arm or the surgical arm. Simple two-arm randomization. The problem, of course, is that this is not a blinded study, as it's a surgical operation. So, you know, the question arises, if somebody's in the medical arm of the study and their pressure remains very high, there is the option for surgery in terms of a crossover, and that's a huge worry to us, because if everybody crosses over from the medical arm to the surgical arm, then the trial becomes invalid. So we've looked very carefully at the crossover rate, and I'll come on to that. So how do we get going? Started ethics in 2004, and that was relatively straightforward. It went through MREC. My feeling about the ethics process is the most important piece of paper is the information sheet. And we were fortunate in that the information sheet was short. We managed to get it down to one page. And one thing we're concerned about with subsequent studies is the information sheets have got very, very long, some of them up to 6 or 7 pages. You know, you've got to remember that we're taking consent from relatives of unconscious patients who are in a very distraught state. To try and expect them to wade through 7 pages of information sheet is not practical. So we're very keen on a short information sheet. R&D approval in most trusts went relatively smoothly, but unfortunately that's not been universal. I'll come on to that. And then we've had issues with contracts, particularly with individual centres. The study's complicated in that the patients are unconscious, so we can't take consent from them. And there was a concern a few years ago that we might not be able to proceed with the study for that reason, in that the patients themselves couldn't consent. That's now been clarified. We take consent from the next of kin on admission. The advantage of doing it on admission is that we're talking to the relatives in a very controlled environment. We can warn them that pressure may go up, in which case we may wish to randomize them. That's much more effective than trying to explain the study when the pressure's high and we need to randomize them very quickly. And consent's usually taken by the registrar on call, or the registrar on call discusses with the relatives the diagnosis, the prognosis, and then mentions there may be somebody coming to talk to them about research studies. And we've been very fortunate, and it's very unusual for somebody to actually turn down consent for the operation. We've also been fortunate now in having a waiver, because many of these patients are unknown when they come in, or the relatives are uncontactable, so the Ethics Committee have agreed that we can apply for independent consultant approval. Can I mention, when we started, we had no funding. We realised that head injuries come in at all times of the day and night, and we needed access to some form of randomisation process that was 24 hours. We didn't have the funding for sophisticated web-based mechanism, so we thought, where on earth can you find somebody who's by a telephone for 24 hours a day, all times? So we thought about that and actually approached the switchboard at Addenbrookes. Spoke to the switchboard manager, explained the study to them. They took the whole thing on board, put up a dedicated telephone line. That was the pilot, and we have maintained that. It's been an extremely successful mechanism. They're very professional about it. They have the randomization code stratified by centre. There's a logbook down there, and that has been quite effective, and we're very grateful to them for that. So in order to try and smooth things, Liz has designed this flow chart to try and make recruitment as simple as possible, checking inclusion and exclusion criteria, 24-hour phone number. We get the investigators to fax back information to us so they've understood the randomization code correctly. That's then cross-checked with the logbook in the switchboard. So where have we got to? Well, since 2004, we've had 47 centres that have contributed patients, 10 more initiating ready to start recruitment. It started in Cambridge, went further UK, and then into Europe and worldwide, and we're hoping to get 70 centres by the time we complete. Again, you know, when we started, we thought, well, CRF, should we try and go web-based? We actually went paper-based for the pilot. This, again, has been successful. We expect postal return, and that works relatively well. The CRF is simple. We've just gone for a number of tick boxes, minimizing the use of free text, 6 pages, and then there's also a daily sheet. But again, that has worked relatively well. But, you know, often Liz does chase it, and Liz does go a fair amount of traveling in order to try and complete these forms in certain centres. The follow-up for these patients is difficult. You know, they're nomadic, they have cognitive issues. Often they don't remember receiving the questionnaires. They're sent by post, maybe resent, and then telephoned. But, you know, we're doing relatively well given the population of around a 94% follow-up. So that's the good news. Now, I thought it might be interesting just to share with you some of the hurdles that we've encountered, and I've divided these into what I call the sort of bureaucratic issues and the clinical issues. So I said ethics has been relatively straightforward. You know, once we got the MREC, other trusts fell into line, even for the centres further afield. R&D has been more problematic. You know, Addenbrookes has been very supportive. Most trusts in the UK have been okay. There have been some that have taken 1 or even 2 years to grant approval. Contracts have, again, been quite difficult, particularly for some of the international centres in terms of trying to get the agreement nailed. The budget has been worked relatively well. We under-budgeted for travel. We've had to overrun because of recruitment issues, and we're applying for a cost extension of about £150,000, and hope to hear about that shortly. This has been quite an issue, NHS support costs. When we started, this wasn't an issue at all, but when we're trying to get R&D approval or contracts, people are very obsessed about the amount of time registrars are taking to consent patients. Again, I think, you know, at the end of the day, these registrars are looking after these patients anyway. They're involved in their clinical care. To talk about the research as part of that clinical care, I think, is quite valuable. But, of course, the advantage of this is then it does give you access to CLRN funding. I was going to talk about protocol insurance shortly. And then there's the clinical issues that will also come over, as Jane mentioned, recruitment rate, issues of trial fatigue. It's not a blinded study, which may lead to lack of equipoise, the issues of crossover. So when the train really came off the rails in 2009, when we were suddenly aware of this concept of protocol insurance. We hadn't previously had protocol insurance. It had never been an issue. And the sponsor, the university and R&D, understandably became concerned about this, to the point that in 2009 we have been allowed to recruit no further centres in terms of no new contracts, no new centres, without protocol insurance in place. We went through the university insurers to a broker, and this was the premium. This is the insurance for the protocol. This isn't the insurance for the operation, which is being done anyway, or for other treatment. This is purely against negligence because we designed the protocol incorrectly, and that was the premium. All right, and 1.15 million, it's not, you know, in terms of proportion of the grant, I mean, it's 250,000, but it was insurmountable. We couldn't fund it. We went to the NIHR, who felt it wasn't their responsibility, and again, that is understandable. They did not design the protocol. The university, very reluctant to fund it. In the end, we've compromised in that we've now got what we call the blanket country policy. This has cost £42,000 and covers these countries. The UK is relatively cheap. We thought it would be quite easy to insure some European countries. They have been impossible. The premium is up to this. One of the easiest countries we found protocol insurance for, which absolutely astonished me, was the USA. Countries like Hungary, Romania, are absolutely impossible. So where have we got to? Well, as I said, we've been going for several years. Target's now 400. We've recruited 317, 47 centres. It is predominantly UK-based, and you know, that has pros and cons. We're familiar with the way protocols are run in the UK, but we're very keen that this is an international study, and I think one of the drawbacks of the protocol insurance is that has restricted the number of overseas centres joining the study. And I suspect as we go on, the proportion of UK may increase further. We were hoping to finish in 2010. For various reasons, that hasn't been the case. And as I said, we've applied for a cost extension and we're hoping to complete recruitment now. It'll be December 2012 when we anticipate we'll get to the 400. The recruitment curve's quite interesting. This is the number of patients that we've recruited in each quarter since 2004. And clearly at the beginning we had very few. Cambridge was the first, then we got Newcastle on board and then some other UK centres. And although with time there's been fluctuations and perhaps a trend of increasing numbers with time, there hasn't really been the exponential growth in recruitment that we were hoping that we would see. And we've asked ourselves, well, why is that? If you look at this graph, it shows that the number of hospitals that centres that have actually been able to recruit has increased steadily with time. But the number of patients has not kept up with that, in that as we get more centres, we're not getting that many more patients. And the reason we feel for that is lack of equipoise. So what's happening is that patients are going in the study, they're randomised to surgery, and there is a feeling out there that the patients with a decompressive craniectomy are doing well. You know, the outcome is not entirely blinded. They know patients are doing well, so some centres have stopped putting patients in the trial. They're just doing the operation, straight to a decompressive craniectomy. And, you know, that's clearly of concern. But I suspect that's why recruitment hasn't been as quick as we thought. The other issue I mentioned about was the concern of crossover. If patients in the medical arm are failing treatment, people will have the option to cross them over to surgery. And again, that was a worry, because if many patients crossed over, then the primary endpoint on an intention to treat analysis would become invalid. We thought a crossover rate of around 25% was acceptable, and that's how the study was powered, and currently the crossover rate is 20%. And this is an important slide because it shows how the crossover rate changed with time. And what we got quite anxious around 2007 in that crossover rate appeared to be increasing. Patients were being randomized, they were in the study, people thought that decompressed craniectomy possibly a good thing, and the crossover rate was beginning to climb. Towards the end of 2007, we made a concerted effort to explain, when we were presenting the study, on the problems of crossover and the impact on the analysis. You know, equipoise remains, and since then we've managed to maintain the crossover rate at a relatively acceptable value. Now, when we started Rescue ICP, the Australians had a similar study. It's slightly different in terms of the ICP thresholds, the timing of surgery, the nature of the patients in terms of the type of head injury. And the Australian study, DECRA, was going along in parallel. They were having more difficulty recruiting than us, and in fact they cut their numbers to 155. But we knew in January of this year that DECRA was going to be published in March. And, you know, we were clearly very anxious. What happens to your study if a similar study publishes? So DECRA, the Australian study, was relatively smaller. Only 155 patients were randomised. The inclusion criteria did differ. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in March. And there was a, you know, huge debate amongst ourselves, the other Rescue ICP investigators and centres. What's DECRA going to show? What will be the impact of DECRA results on Rescue ICP? And the results of DECRA were very surprising. Most people thought when DECRA was published that it would perhaps show no difference in outcome, or decompressive craniectomy may save life, but at the expense of a very high disability. Interestingly, DECRA showed that there was no difference in mortality, but there was significantly more disability in the survivors following decompressive craniectomy than following the medical treatment. So this was very adverse in terms of decompressive craniectomy and was very controversial. A lot of people were very unhappy about it. It was quite heated arguments at various meetings where it was presented. Our instinct was that maybe if there's lack of equipoise in decompressive craniectomy, the fact that DECRA is negative may actually help Rescue ICP recruitment. I think if DECRA was positive, it would have meant more people didn't put patients in the study and just went straight for surgery. But I mean, we wait to see. This was only published in March. I think we have to see the impact of DECRA on Rescue ICP recruitment. Finally, you know, chasing the CRFs has been relatively easy in most centres. This has been quite difficult, and of course is absolutely essential for the consort guidelines and publication. The screening logs, it is difficult to get people to to complete these. You know, we pay £500 a patient for each patient randomised. We don't provide any extra funding for the screening log, and perhaps we could discuss ways of improving screening log completion. So in summary, it's been going on several years. Started in 2004, we got definitive funding in 2007, and then there's been various endpoints. We're currently hoping to complete recruitment in December 2012. Originally, it was a six-month follow-up. The MRC felt that that was actually not long enough for these patients, and I think they're absolutely right about that, so we are keen to proceed for a two-year follow-up. The funding is now transferred from the MRC to the NIHR, and that's been relatively seamless, and as I said, we're hoping to hear shortly about a small cost extension. So to conclude, in terms of the study itself, we feel that decreased craniectomy is still a treatment option. There are issues with the surgery, particularly in the light of DECRA. You know, rescue ICP is ongoing. We've got 83 more to go, and you know, hopefully we will get there relatively soon. It has been a long journey. There have been several ups and downs. I think the protocol insurance was a particular issue. I think one of the important concepts is we've felt, and I felt, you know, from 2004 we got approval for this study, and since then the goalposts have changed, NHS support costs, protocol insurance, and I just wonder whether there's some mechanism in that if you have a study improved, those are the goalposts for the duration of that study, and to suddenly move the goalpost during the study is difficult in terms of recruitment, but can also lead to potential bias. The fact that we've not had new overseas centres since 2009, it could be argued that that actually could affect the results. You know, the study, the science has changed through the study for reasons beyond our control. One of the bonuses, it's been very interesting, and I've learned a lot about head injured patients and how they're managed in different centres. I've visited most UK units. When we set the study up, we were going to Italy, and we looked at the map, and I thought, Milan, sounds nice, Florence, Rome, Venice, thanks very much. I spoke to the Italian investigator. He recommended three centres in the industrial part of Turin, so it's not always been rosy. Some of the hurdles have been avoidable. I think some of the R&D issues have been certainly avoidable. Some equipoise and crossover have been unavoidable. Would we do it again? Well, we all agree we're never going to do this again. The team have said that's the end of that. And then next week, the team started putting the ethics together for Son of Rescue ICP, a study of acute subdural hematomas. So we can't help ourselves. I'm really, I suppose, spokesman for the study. It's involved an enormous number of people without whom it would not have happened. My consultant colleagues in Cambridge, Peter Kirkpatrick and John Pickard, the team, Ivan, Angelos, Liz, that I've mentioned here. Investigators beyond Cambridge in the UK, we have representatives in most of the European countries. Donald Shaw chairs the Data Monitoring Committee, he's a neurosurgeon in Liverpool. Tony Bell, the steering committee. And finally, I'd like to thank the funders. The Academy of Medical Sciences did fund the pilot once we got up and running. Then the MRC took over the funding currently from the NIHR, and hopefully we will, with their support, be able to finish in December 2012. There's a website for the study. That's my email address, and thank you very much for listening. Yeah, I mean, fortunately, neurosurgical registrars, there aren't that many of them in the country. There's very few units. We publicise the study at other meetings. You know, there's a British neurotrauma group for the trainees, so the study's well known amongst the trainees. And often, you know, if they're very busy in the night, then they will just mention the study. Then one of the research fellows, when they come in the morning, will pick the study up. So that's not been a huge issue. In some ways, it's made life easier because we used to have quite fierce debates about whether to do a decompressive craniectomy or not. And in some ways, because it's now randomised, it's taken out of our hands to a degree. So that has made life a bit easier for people.
Just
Yeah. For each patient randomized,
and the question is, do the units claim it? Do they use it?
Most people do claim it. We don't send it until we've got the outcome data, so we wait for the 6 months. And most put it in a slush fund or a research fund for the department. It's not a huge sum of money, but if you recruit 10 patients, you know, it's useful. I know there's a concern, and I think Barbara Gregson's here from Newcastle, about the Stitch study, and we've had this argument that although £500 isn't very much in UK terms, if you recruit in some other countries, it is quite a lot of money. So the R&D here was purely responsible for NHS patients. So R&D haven't really been directly involved with the same sort of contract that we have with R&D and other trusts. So we have a separate contract, an agreement that's signed off by the university and R&D. And that has been problematic for certain countries. Well, you know, that's a good question, because there are other overseas trials that are ongoing that don't have such insurance. I guess that there is a perception that this is high risk and that protocol insurance should be in place, but I don't know what other people's experiences of recruiting overseas and the need for this insurance.
Good morning, Matt Sides from the MRC Clinical Trials Unit. That was a really nice presentation. You've clearly put a lot of work into making this trial work. I just had a simple practical question. I don't know very much about head injury, but you're looking at long-term follow-up here. So I'm guessing your patients generally get better and go home. You take consent from the relatives when the patient comes into hospital. Does a patient then need to re-consent when they come
around? That's a really,
and if so, do they generally agree?
That's a critical point. And again, that's not something that was an issue that we started, but has become an issue now. The problem is that many of these patients do not make a good recovery. And there are huge issues on assessing their capacity to understand the consenting process. So if some of them have made a very good recovery and are deemed to have that capacity, then we would certainly talk to them about it. But, you know, there are vast numbers of these patients who do not have that ability to actually digest the information, and those we haven't reconsented them. But we've always said to the relatives, as the trial goes along, you know, they have the right to withdraw.
Maggie Wilcox, patient. I was interested in the length of follow-up because it seems to me that the long-term effects are a real problem. And do the relatives actually get a questionnaire to fill in as well as the patient? You know, it's very difficult, of the long-term personality changes and various other things. It's a really important...
I mean, the questionnaires we use are the extended Glasgow outcome score, which is an 8-point scale from death to full recovery, and then the SF36 quality of life. We haven't specifically asked relatives, and one of the things we were conscious about is sending too much paperwork, too many questionnaires. But I mean, I take your point, the impact on the family is absolutely critical. But I know that, you know, often the Glasgow outcome score is well completed, but by the time they get to the end of the SF36, which is 6 or 7 pages, you know, it's not perfectly completed in all cases. Which is why I think telephone follow-up is also very important. You know, there are ethical issues about phoning people, but we thought ethically the most important thing is to get as high a follow-up as we can.
I think there needs to be another study into the psychosocial aspects of living with the effects.
Sure. I mean, for the Cambridge patients, we do all that. They have neuropsychological assessments. We talk to the families. We have involvement with the charity Headway. But we can't expect every centre to do that as part of this study.
Okay, thank you very much. Freddie Hanley, Oxford. And congratulations, huge achievement. You mentioned several times something very important, which is equipoise.
Yeah.
And you mentioned sometimes loss of equipoise, which didn't seem to be based on strong new evidence. Mm. It was just opinions. And I was very curious to know whether you accepted that or whether you made any attempts to reverse that. And did you do, you know, did you question it, in other words?
I mean, every time we present the study, you know, the protocol, we try and explain there is no evidence. You know, people should still be in equipoise. But people remember the surgical successes. That's the problem. They don't remember the surgical failures. But, I mean, an equipoise does change. In the 1970s, this operation was very popular. You know, there was an awful lot of it about, and then suddenly it stopped. And that's because people suddenly realised that it wasn't a good thing to do. And then a new generation of surgeons came along, and it got very popular again in the 90s. So what we're hoping is to try and nail this equipoise issue, and hopefully by getting the result, then it'll stop this waxing and waning.
Fantastic presentation, an outstanding effort to do the study. Sorry, Tom Treasure, I should have said. I noticed Martin Buxton's name, and it prompts what a simple question, really. How are you going to handle health economics within this?
Yeah, for time reasons, I didn't go into all the details, but there is a health economic analysis ongoing, both in terms of cost. What we're trying to do is now the cost of the initial treatment. You know, does decompressive craniectomy get people off intensive care more quickly? Is it cheaper in the short term? What you can do with the SF36 is translate it into an FS6D and get some idea of health economic analysis in terms of how much dependency are these patients in terms of nursing care. You know, are they getting back to work? So we are trying to address both those issues. Again, that's something that the MRC, when the referees came back, introduced, for which I think we're very grateful.
So thank you very much again, Peter. If only all surgical trials were like that.
Well,
then.
That's
a good one to start with. Thank you. So our next speaker is Alinda Sharples, a statistician by training and background, program leader in the Biostatistics Hub in Cambridge. Very pleased to have you here, Alinda, today. And she's going to be talking about some cardiac trials and issues around recruitment. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. I work for the Medical Research Council, but I've worked for a long time in collaboration with Papworth Hospital, and this is a Papworth Hospital coordinated trial, the AMAZE trial. Okay, so I'll briefly tell you a little bit about the trial, but we're not going to dwell on the details. It's a trial of ablation techniques in conjunction with elective cardiac surgery for people who have pre-existing atrial fibrillation, so arrhythmias in the heart. And the control is not to have ablation alongside their surgery. We've got an intermediate clinical endpoint, which is returning the heart into sinus rhythm. And what we're really interested in is how this affects patients. So that our real final endpoint is patient-focused, and it's to do with survival, quality of life, quality-adjusted survival, and because it's NIHR-funded, also to do with cost-effectiveness. It's a multi-centre trial, and seems like 400 is the number of patients that surgical trials need these days. So we needed 400 patients. We recruit patients at pre-admission clinics and consent them there and then start the baseline tests. But patients are randomised in theatre. We had a target recruitment of 3 to 4 patients a month at Papworth Hospital, the coordinating centre, and then 2 to 3 patients in approximately 5 or 6 of the centres we thought would be sufficient to recruit the patients in about 18 months. And we were optimistic. We were really, really optimistic because we'd done some initial audits, and from those centres that were interested initially, we'd worked out that there were at least 400 eligible patients a year at those centres. And so we thought we were being reasonably conservative, given an 18-month recruitment period. It's a fairly pragmatic trial, so it reflects practice, and there were very few exclusions, so we should be able to include most patients who come along. Patients are having surgery. They're having surgery anyway. We don't have to set up new referral practices or new pathways. They're coming into us. RAF is fairly widely used. It doesn't require a long training period. The control groups are going to have surgery as well. It's not that they're not getting their surgery, so they feel like they're having something. It's just the kind of add-on bit they're not having. And there was really no direct evidence that patients derive a lot of benefit from having their AF addressed during cardiac surgery. So people were generally in equipoise. It was a question that needed to be answered. And people were really quite enthusiastic. I've never seen so many surgeons agree on anything. So I was really, really quite optimistic. So was I right to be optimistic? Well, not really. It's been quite a difficult period to get the recruitment we needed. So let's try and work out why that happened. When we finally got the money, we launched the trial in 2009. It's ongoing, so still recruiting. The trial was launched by Sam Nasheff, the chief investigator up there, who unfortunately can't be with us today, but he launched the trial. We had a big hoo-ha. We gave it a brilliant name of Amaze, cracking. We got all sorts of branding, merchandise, pens, mouse pads. We've got Christmas cards, amusing posters. It was fantastic. We all felt brilliant. And then nothing happened really very much. It took kind of 3 months for people to go from consent to randomization because we had to wait for the waiting lists. In retrospect, we could have gone and taken people from the waiting lists there and perhaps found extra people in that early phase when things were quiet. We didn't do that. But, you know, perhaps that might have helped a little bit at the beginning. Local approvals in other centres were slow for all sorts of reasons. But that did kind of hold up spreading the trial out to other centres. But during planning, we had 8 centres signed up and who went through all the site's specific initiations. And they were spread out. There was a reasonable spread across the country. So that seemed to be quite good. And during the trial, we managed to recruit another 4 centres. And they're spread right from Newcastle down to Plymouth. So we'd pretty much covered the whole of England anyway. So that seemed brilliant. Hurrah. And then some centres pulled out. So that was sort of a bit more disappointing. And some centres got very firmly wedged back on the fence and decided they'd wait and see what happened. And they're still kind of not quite sure whether they want to recruit or not. But 10 centres have recruited patients. Most of those have been at Papworth. Well, not most, but the biggest centre is Shirley Papworth. And partly that's because it's the coordinating centre and partly because there are 10 surgeons at Papworth, all of whom have signed up and are prepared to put patients into the trial. Some other centres are performing well despite a single surgeon involved. Some centres are fairly recent, but then some centres have been with us an awfully long time and, you know, I've had a couple of dribbles of patients and not really been able to provide further patients. Okay, so we did some things to try and help with recruitment. Obviously, initiation of new centres is important, and we talk about recruitment there and give some advice on how that might be done. At Papworth and I think other centres, there are monthly management meetings of the surgeons, and trials are on the agenda at those meetings. So once a month, the trials are discussed, and we talk about recruitment, and we try and keep it in the minds of the people there. There's other internal trial promotion. So we try and get cardiologists, junior staff, nurses, all signed up so that they will highlight cases that might be recruited. We recommend that all medical notes for people coming into those pre-admission clinics are screened so that we don't miss any people. So those are the things kind of internally that I think we've actually been very good at. What we've been less good at, I would say, is that we haven't spent so much time going to local, national, international meetings and talking about the trial. So I'm really pleased here. If there are any cardiac surgeons out there who want to take part, you know, we need to get more on the agenda in those meetings. We haven't talked to the local arrhythmia specialty groups. It wasn't considered particularly helpful. And I think even if you're not out talking about these things, if you go to a cardiac surgery meeting, then we should be having posters or leaflets laid around the place so that people have it in their minds. They can ask what it is and perhaps try and encourage inclusion there. And also there are specialist training courses that deal specifically with arrhythmias and cardiac surgery. So I think through those are people who are particularly interested in learning the techniques and maybe don't have huge lack of equipoise at this stage. So we need to make more of those. Communication, always important in every situation. So partly through initiation, but also continued communication is really important. And partly we do this through trial steering groups, and all the centres we expect or we invite to those meeting groups, to those group meetings, should I say. And we'll try and attach them to scientific meetings if possible to encourage people. We try to have them face-to-face but with a telecon option so that people who can't come and see us will... will ring in. And those have been really, really important for keeping people's interest and allowing people to express their difficulties. And we've varied the venue because it's great to have a really good coordinating centre, but without the other centres, it doesn't work. So if you can vary the venue so that those people understand that their part in the trial is just as important as everyone else, then I think that really helps them to maintain their interest and activity. We've set up recently a monthly teleconference primarily for research nurses as fixed time every month so that people can ring in, just have a general moan about the surgeons if that's what they want to do, or just get their problems aired. We can talk about recruitment and perhaps any sort of small niggles we can try and fix at that time. And there's this is Chrissy, the trial coordinator, and she has a telephone helpline so that we can address any difficulties in a really timely fashion. Okay, we've got newsletters which come out every 6 months. The tone of the newsletters, we try and keep really positive and upbeat and set targets rather than kind of we're worried that recruitment's slow. So I think it's important for those to be positive. And apart from giving information, they've also got things like quizzes. And the chief investigator is a Guardian crossword compiler, so he makes these crosswords. But the great thing is it means you don't just kind of get the newsletter, have a quick flick through it, throw it away. That newsletter sits on your desk for a little while, and it all helps to keep the trial in people's minds. And you get a Christmas card, and we've got some interesting posters, which the coordinator is very good at. And if all that fails, then we get tough. We send the boys in. We don't send the boys in, but we get tough in the sense that we make sure that the money follows the patient. So patients, I think we were, in the past, have been quite bad at giving people money and then they haven't performed. We've kind of addressed that now, made sure you only get money if you put patients into the trial. And I think that's, it's public money. We have to protect it. Okay, centre issues. There were some of the issues that have come up during the trial surrounding recruitment are concerns about blinding. People don't like, or certain people don't like putting patients to sleep not knowing what treatment they're going to have. And they don't like patients waking up and then not being told what treatment they've actually had. But we think it's actually quite important to blind because so much of our main outcomes surround quality of life. So if it's not blinded, it casts doubt, I think, on the validity of those results. So we consider it to be quite important to blind everybody. The surgeon knows, thankfully. Other issues have been this issue of equipoise. And I think none of us think that surgeons are shrinking violets. They're generally quite confident people. But I think if you're the only surgeon in a centre doing this procedure and other surgeons in the centre have strong feelings in one way or the other, it's actually quite difficult to keep your strength of opinion. So I think lack of equipoise or lack of strong enough equipoise has been a difficult problem. We've had very variable support from other clinical colleagues, very variable support from the CLRN, who in some centres will go through all the notes. In other centres, they seem to do a fairly minimal amount of support. And variable research experience and academic experience from the surgeons who take part. And I think the more experience you have in research, the easier it is to sign up to these ideas of equipoise and blinding and all the technical aspects. And, of course, we're all under pressure with service. So I think some of the reasons we didn't recruit were maybe we were optimistic when setting targets. Notes not being screened, I think, is one of the main reasons. And we think at Papworth we screen about 20 notes to get two eligible patients, one of whom will recruit. If you miss, you know, a morning's notes, you've probably missed one or two patients. And that's, you know, that's really quite important. So we have to have consistent note screening. Research staff tend to be on short-term contracts and to move around a lot. So staff turnover, and particularly having a gap between your research nurses, is really quite damaging. Once recruitment dips, it's very hard to get it up again, I think. We've had both short and long waiting lists as excuses for not recruiting. I'm not quite sure about that. And we had centres that were... regional centres for swine flu. So their ITU beds were all blocked with swine flu cases. We had to stop cardiac surgery. So that was also a difficult problem. So you can see we, after the launch, we recruited slowly. It picked up as more centres and all our techniques for encouraging recruitment kicked in. It hasn't really kind of taken off in any sort of exponential way. But I think what we have done is managed to maintain the sort of recruitment rate that we've had. And it's looking like we're getting to stages at least now where there'll be useful results to come out from the trial. Just a few general comments. I think because of the complexity of cardiac surgery, you have to have multi-centre trials. It's no good being, if we can do it in one very good centre and nowhere else. So it has to be a multi-centre study, and that requires the chief investigator to be strong and give strong leadership and keep those centres together. So that's number one. The second thing is good research nurse is absolutely crucial to recruitment, absolutely crucial. Support from junior staff and CLNRN is also important, and from other clinicians, particularly if they control the pathway through which patients come. And all that requires us to have realistic funding. And just one final sort of technical point. This was designed to be a pragmatic trial, so we're trying to reflect what happens in practice in the NHS as much as possible. And pragmatic trials are going to recruit faster than ones that are purely explanatory. You may have slightly more variable results, but they will be more generalisable to the people you want to recruit. And finally, we couldn't have expected swine flu to block up our beds and cause those problems. So it was an unexpected outcome, and we didn't have any contingency. I think we need to build in a bit of contingency into trials and not and assume they're going to recruit slower than we really expect. Okay, so I just want to thank the whole huge team. I'm sure we've all got a huge packed slide with all these people in. Particularly, I want to thank Chrissy, the trial coordinator, who does all the great graphics, and Hester, the trial manager, who makes sure everything goes as smoothly as it can. Okay, and thank you for listening. Okay.
Thank you very much, Linda. Questions for Linda?
Tom Treasure. Hello, Linda. Very, very nice presentation. And I'd be proud of 150 patients in a study. A lot of us are struggling to get to that. So, you know, there's some good of it. Two, there are many, many obstacles, and you've outlined them, and there are all sorts of things which we can't overcome or are very difficult. But our own colleagues, you'd like to get on side. Two points and questions. One is that, as you know very well, cardiologists offer radiofrequency ablation in a different context, but they offer it, and also tend to prescribe surgery in cardiac practice. Are they an obstacle, and is there a way of getting to the cardiologist? The other question is, we've seen it in both of these presentations, and it's quite familiar, that the inspiring and leading centre gets the cases, and then you've got, just picking one off your list with no particular significance, but Brompton with two. What do we do to get people to join other people's studies? And what do you think the obstacle is there? Why aren't they?
So the cardiologists, I think it's a good point. We do need other people who are surrounding the surgical practice to be signed up. And we have a cardiologist on board, and we have presented to the local cardiology research meeting. And generally at Papworth, I think they're signed up. They're not so important at this. Okay. The centres, Brompton, I think part of Brompton is it's a very active centre in itself, and it has all sorts of its own trials going on. And therefore, you know, it's used to being the big brother, if you like, and I suppose it's going to give priority to its own trials. So I'm not sure if that was the reason exactly. I'm not sure if you ever genuinely get to the reasons for these centres, but I think it's purely just trying to get people who really are signed in to this question. And part of having a history of research in this area, even if it's fairly small scale case series research, somebody with some real interest in the area. We haven't really got networks in cardiology the way the cancer networks are set up, and maybe if we had stronger networks, that might help. And I'm hoping the fact that we have more surgical trials means that we'll get together in groups, we'll learn who we can work with, we'll learn who the recruiters are, and we can, help each other.
The surgical network might be something we'll come back to.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a very honest and informative talk. Thank you. I enjoyed it. I suppose two questions, really. One is, are you sure that some of this is not just inexperience, lack of experience in randomised controlled trials? I wonder how many of your centres are really recruiting to randomised controlled trials, dare I say, even the Brompton. So that's question one. So the second one is that I think networks are an opportunity, and it's about disseminating, it is about spreading the word. And actually, there is a registrar network in cardiothoracic surgery, and they could actually, it's a kind of bottom-up strategy, they could actually disseminate your trial into the centres and encourage the consultants to participate and enter patients. Mm. Two thoughts.
I don't know if I'll probably speak out of turn now. I'm from Yorkshire, one of the problems with the bottom-up approach is medicine is an incredibly hierarchical structure. I'm an academic, so for me it seems incredibly hierarchical. And for a registrar to come in and try and persuade a consultant surgeon to take part, I perceive as quite difficult. The surgeons here could probably tell me more than that. I forgot your first question, sorry.
And the networks, is the other comment?
Yes.
Are you sure?
The experience.
History and experience.
Yeah, I think it certainly varies. In Papworth, there's a history. I've been working with Papworth. The first clinical trial I did was published in 1998. The first surgical clinical trial was published in The Lancet in 1998. So the R&D unit there certainly have a long history. Individual surgeons, not so much. And it's not generally within the culture of surgeons in the same way it is in the culture of physicians these days, is also my perception.
Michael Dweck, London. I enjoyed your talk, and it is a very impressive setup that you have. One area we haven't touched on is on the role of data monitoring committees in the context of surgical trials. And going back to the last question, what happens when the data monitoring committee is looking at small centres recruiting one or two patients? Are you under a lot of pressure to try and consider closure of these centres?
So, Sorry, so far they haven't put us under pressure. The NIH are very keen that we don't put money into those centres. The difficulty is that even if you've got a drib and drab of patients in those centres, you need their follow-up. You know, every patient in a trial is incredibly important, and you need the follow-up. So we certainly don't follow up with with monitoring of those centres, for instance. So we're not, once centres have been in for a long time and they're proved not to be performing, we don't spend a lot of time, you know, trying to get them going again.
Well, thank you very much, Linda. That's raised some very important issues. Great. So our next speaker is Richard Shaw. Richard's an academic oral and maxillofacial surgeon from and he's a PI2 trial, but he's going to talk to us about some general issues around
recruitment. Thanks very much, Jane, and thanks for the invitation to the meeting. And I'm not going to speak intensely about one particular trial, and I'm not going to speak hardly at all about the nature of head and neck cancer. I'm going to present hopefully the first bit of work on some trial methodology work in trying to get our head and neck cancer surgical trials working a little bit better. So we come from a position of, I wouldn't say near nihilism, but 10 years ago there were no head and neck cancer trials, certainly no surgical trials in Britain. 5 years ago there had been sort of one, maybe two, and they'd fallen really on their face and not achieved anything. So things are looking pretty bad. But there is some good news. Head and neck research in the UK has picked up in the last 5 years with a very vibrant NCRI clinical studies group. And last year, the years we got data for, around about 12 or 15% of patients with head and neck cancer were recruited to trials. And, of course, some of those are non-trials, some of them, but the randomization numbers are quite good, 750 coming from quite small numbers over the last 3 or 4 years. There are 20 studies on the head and neck portfolio, and in fact, 4 of those are surgical trials, and we have a very vibrant clinical studies group in surgery and localized therapy. So a lot of what I'm going to say is about barriers to recruitment, but this is off the back of some activity now and something to talk about, whereas a few years ago, there would have been nothing to talk about. So this is, I guess, a little bit of information about the trials and the background of the work I'm going to present. I was invited by Dean to sit on this national working party, and that's what got me thinking about it. And in the end, what happened was we invited the chief investigators on these 3 surgical trials to present to the working group. And the work that I'm going to present comes out of that meeting and some initial discussions from that. And the actual work that's been carried out has been kindly helped in by the MRC Trials Hub in Liverpool, with Paula Williamson, Catherine Tudor-Smith, and a PhD student called Gatinda, who's actually helped me enormously with delivering this survey. So what we've done is we've done a survey of the people who recruit to these 3 trials. There's the SEND trial, the PET-NEC trial, and the HOPON trial. So one sentence about each of those 3 trials, just so you understand what sort of trials they are. The SEND trial is like a pure surgical trial. People with early stage head and neck cancer either receive a selective neck dissection or not, with oncological outcomes and quality of life outcomes. The PET-NET trial, a little bit more complex, patients receiving principally non-surgical treatment for more advanced head and neck cancer, and their requirement for a neck dissection is determined by a PET scan, or they go ahead for a neck dissection. So it's basically looking about how a PET scan can interface with surgery. And the HOPON trial is a declaration of interest. I'm the chief investigator on the HOPON trial. Is about that large majority of head and neck cancer patients who receive radiotherapy somewhere down the line in their treatment are then very prone to necrosis of their jaws. And we're trying to understand whether using hyperbaric oxygen, putting a patient in a chamber for 30 dives over 30 days, actually reduces the risk of jaw necrosis. So that's what the trials are about. They're in and around surgery, and one of them is pure surgery. They're funded by CRUK HTA. They're run by proper trials units and well-established and experienced trials units. I'm very grateful to the trial coordinators and the chief investigators for allowing us basically to use their trials to do this research. And they've all been open, I guess, 3 or 4 years. So the recruitment data here, there's a bit of detail here. So in terms of the recruitment as a percentage of the total, what we can see is that the SEND trial has so far recruited about 20% of its total and about a third of what it should have done according to projections. So there's quite a lot of work to do with that particular trial. With the PET-NEC trial, what actually happened, it's recruited around about half of its total, and there was an adjusted recruitment target. So because recruitment had been quite good, 291 patients is a very impressive total for a surgical trial, and the HTA have extended it by 2 years. And with the Hop-On trial, which is mine, it's a slightly smaller trial, and we've just fallen off our recruitment targets. So we recruited about a third of our total, and as we are sitting here today, that's probably 72% of what I should have. So in terms of special measures and things that have been done, the SEND trial is co-funded by a head and neck research charity, and they've provided a number of research nurses to attend various centres to try and help this. And there's been a process of educational meetings and the chief investigator going around the centres trying to invigorate it. And Ian Hutchison's a very vigorous person, and I think that's been successful in opening some new centres. In terms of PETNEC, I think the special measures really have been a realisation that the initial recruitment targets were a bit ambitious, so there's just been an extension of the trial. And in Hop-On, none as yet, but we may have to address whether we have to either adjust our recruitment target or the length of time or the way we're going about things. Interestingly, just I mentioned once, we tried to get Hop-On open for the last 18 months abroad, and these issues about sponsorship and non-negligent indemnity have really hit us in the neck. We've got fantastic hyperbaric academic centres in Copenhagen and Holland, and we've just not been able to open the trial because of these difficulties, and they're not at all straightforward to argue away. So the method we use was basically to ask all the people, all the centres, their opinions on barriers to recruitment using one of these survey gizmo things. And, you know, we basically scored it a little bit like that. You get a few pages of things that might be a problem for the trial, and we've analysed the data. So we asked people to rank problems as either no problem at all, a very mild problem, or the more severe end, 2 as a moderate problem, 3 as a severe. And we divided our questions up into some sort of general questions initially about what role the person answering the questionnaire did, what staff they had available, and what their expectations of the trial were. And then we asked some questions, so trial-related questions. You know, is the design wrong? Is the competition with your patients for other trials? Are the trial design-specific issues? Next, about the site. Is there a problem with your site? Have you got a research nurse? Has your R&D department let you down? Have you got funding for the excess treatment costs? Some patient-related issues. Do the patients routinely refuse consent when you think everything else is right? Does the patient say no? Or do the patients find that extra visits or other burdens placed on them by the trial presents a problem? Are the cultural barriers from the patient actually sort of getting the trial or understanding it? Then the clinical team, you know, do you have a lack of time in your clinic? Do you have any training? Do you, you know, as a clinical team, are you pro or anti-research? Are you anti this trial? So these are the type of questions we've asked. And we, of course, we've come to this with some assumptions, is that we think we know what the type of things that might be barriers. And, of course, that might be a flawed assumption. So we provided plenty of free text so people can vent their spleen, and they have done on a number of issues. The way in which this questionnaire was put together was some previous work from Paula Williamson, some paediatric trials, and they've got some experience on paediatric A&E trials, emergency paediatric medicine trials, which are also considered a difficult area to recruit to. And it's some of that generic knowledge which was fed into this survey design, which I was very grateful for. So I'm going to summarise the results. We closed the trial on the 1st of August and had our first meeting to analyse the data on the 15th, so I don't have the final data. And obviously this will be smartened up and cleaned up and presented very nicely, and we'll try to publish it somewhere. So, but I think the main points are pretty obvious. They're the things that scored the 2s and 3s repeatedly, and they kind of fly off the page at you when you look at the Excel spreadsheets. So we got a pretty good response, and we had 141 complete and partial responses. And they cover 45 centres in total. So we think we probably have got a representative cohort of opinion. Of course, we can do complex things, and when a trial has all three, when a centre has all three trials open and they recruit to 2 and not for the 1, we might give extra weight for the problems they've said they've got with that trial. Whereas when we've got a centre that isn't recruiting to any of the trials, you know, their opinions may not be as valuable. Or you know, you could look at it each way. So there's some work to be done. And I'm not going to present the sort of more complicated analysis. And this is, I guess, the most important slide, because these are the headline points that scored very badly in terms of being barriers to recruitment. So these were common themes really across the three trials generally. The number one was this issue of patients refusing consent and expressing a preference for the one arm of the trial. So there's this issue of equipoise and patients' opinion. The second point was that I haven't got enough time in my busy NHS clinic to do this research. The third point was the consultant surgeon has a preference for one arm of the trial. So again, if the consultant doesn't buy into the equipoise, then presumably we can't expect the patient to do so. The educational level of the patients not being able to completely understand the trial. lack of a research nurse, lack of funding from primary care trusts for excess treatment costs where they're relevant. So on the SEND trial, this wasn't an issue because the extra costs are completely hidden in the NHS and nobody has to sign them off. For the Hop-On trial, big problem, these hyperbaric chambers are run privately and a bill has to land on somebody's desk and somebody has to pay for it. For the PET neck, it's the cost of an extra PET scan. At least it lies within the NHS. And the burden of R&D delays and the general misery of pushing the paper round and round in circles. So I'm going to go through these things, because these, I haven't presented the numbers, but I could do. It's just I'm a bit worried the numbers would change between this and the published paper. But these scored really highly. You know, very frequently people put these as twos and threes. So in terms of barriers to recruitment, and Dion made this point to me. I sent him this initial data for some comments, and I think I agree with him. The patient's refusing to be randomised and the consultant's refusing to randomise because they buy into one side of the trial or the other is the same problem. Patients will be led by what consultants feel. You know, it is a hierarchical system. People look to us as consultants for our decisions. And there's a bit of a culture change needed here where consultants have to admit that they don't know the answer, that the trial is well designed and peer-reviewed, and they have to present it as equipoise. And there could be an issue of training and acceptance of consultant surgeons and whether they actually buy into research at all. You know, and whether this is quite as much culture shock as the cartoon suggests, I don't know. But I think a lot of us in the room, well, probably the people in the room are the converted. It's probably our colleagues who are not in the room, who are consultant surgeons, probably don't buy into the research as much as we'd think. Maybe I'm overanalyzing. People said, you know, consultants are Mr. Busy. They're always running around. They have got very little time for these activities like research. But it's amazing what consultants do find time for when it suits them. You know, they often have lunch. They often have time to visit car showrooms and private hospitals, for example. And it is a question of our priorities. And where this is high up on your priority, because, you know, Dion's nodding, but he's a chief investigator of a trial. Of course, it's his priority. I'm the same. It's my priority. What about the guys who aren't chief investigators of the trial and don't have academic jobs? How do we raise it as their priority? How do you get GPs to vaccinate patients for routine vaccinations? You pay them. And you pay them for the quantity quality. They'll often delegate it out to other members of staff in their team. And, you know, how do you get GPs to do contraceptive services they're not that keen on doing and it's a bit dull for them? They get paid for it. And if it's not rewarded or recognised in NHS, it probably isn't going to happen. So goodwill will get you so far, but if people say they haven't got enough time, I wonder whether that's code for something else. In terms of the NHS, so the Department of Health has this set policy for how research is going to be delivered, and it doesn't work as well as it reads on the tin, because what happens is there are many surgeons who just cannot get hold of a research nurse to do the trial, and for many trials, no research nurse equals no trial. And lack of excess treatment costs. You know, the Department of Health policy on this is absolutely crystal clear. It's an NIHR portfolio study. Therefore, the excess treatment costs are met by the trust or the PCTs, and that's the end of it. Well, this fails left, right, and centre, and they just flat refuse. I only picked this because it landed on my desk yesterday, and it may be too small to read, but what it is, it's a very nice letter to me and my trial coordinator refusing to pay the excess treatment costs in Coventry for this trial and apologising that it may be disappointing news. And there has been a culture shift in excess treatment costs. 2 or 3 years ago, people were not willing to put their decision on paper. They would speak to me on the phone and say, look, sorry, Richard, you know, you've requested these excess treatment costs, and we've actually looked at this. We were willing to fund hyperbaric oxygen before. Now you tell us there's no evidence. We're not funding it. That's it. So because it's research, we're specifically not funding it, but we'll look at individual patient requests where the case is particularly severe, and completely the wrong way around. But they weren't willing to put it on paper because they were worried that Department of Health policy was actually contrary to what they were acting at. Now, they're actually quite happy to put it down, saying, look, we are just closing the door for all research. We're not going to pay excess treatment costs on these studies. So my concern is for many surgical studies, or even radiotherapy studies, where there isn't pharma behind it, the fact that CR UK have given you the key to the door to open the trial, but it's still dramatically underfunded. On the Hop-On trial, I have NHS subvention of £250,000, but that only kicks in after they've started to recruit in any one centre. So the fact that we've given them a glass ceiling of about £10,000 for this group of people to make a decision is no reassurance to them. They don't have any money, let alone £10,000. And I'm not picking on Coventry. In fact, they've tried really hard, and I'm very grateful to them for actually replying nicely, because most of them don't. And in fact, I've had many letters from around. But, you know, you give me the platform, so I've said what my experience is. I had a little whinge. And, of course, this slightly nihilistic head and neck patients, you know, they're very poor socioeconomic groups, and they're all drinkers and smokers, and they don't understand trials, and there's no point. And I don't really buy into that. I don't know whether there are head and neck specific issues. But I would like to comment briefly on the negative effect that ethics committees and the R&D system have on the paperwork. Because you may be able to come up with something that you think might appeal to a head and neck patient, and you take it through your local patient and carer support group. And then it goes to the ethics committee, and they turn it into a 7-page, you know, ridiculous diatribe that nobody wants to read. In fact, I don't think anybody does read it, ever. But they've stopped themselves being sued, which is all, you know, all they're set up for. And I'm really delighted the Academy of Medical Sciences have actually done some plain speaking here. Unequivocal evidence that health research has been jeopardised by the regulatory framework. No evidence this has ever saved a patient any harm. The changes we propose are to improve the environment for clinical trials and embed a culture that values research in the NHS. So we look forward to that. And I think a lot of their comments that have come out this year have been absolutely true. And I'm delighted that some senior medics have told it how it is. And some important negatives, things that didn't score at all highly. You know, I'm delighted to be able to say that all the problems with surgical trials are related to trial design, R&D, patients, primary care trusts, lack of nurses. These are the problems. I'm delighted to say that all surgeons are absolutely angelic, and there is there's no problem with the attitude of surgeons. There's no problems whatsoever about research experience in surgical units or lack of training, or the fact they've never had any training in research techniques. You know, I came to trials, I knew nothing. I learnt a lot about trials, setting the hop on trial, and I'm still learning very fast. And, you know, I don't know where I am on the learning curve. I hate to find out. Get me back in 20 years, I'll tell you. But quite clearly, you know, I've asked the question, and then I'm ignoring the answer, because I don't believe this is true. But how we dress up educating our surgical colleagues is a real challenge, and that's what I'm left with, you know, chairing the surgical subgroup for the next 3 years. We probably can't address it in terms of, you know, we're going to reprogram your brain to be more trials. We probably have to sell it in other ways. And maybe one of Dion's things is you get hold of the senior registrars and the senior trainees rather than those of us who are past it. And there probably aren't issues in these head and neck surgical trials that are unique to head and neck. That's why I haven't talked about head and neck cancer very much. You know, this is a trial and a recent publication from the SPARE trial, the CRUK trial. And the things that come through are they have difficulty presenting the trial in terms of equipoise. Sometimes the way that the research wants to have it, that everything goes through a trust, isn't the way that head and neck cancer is delivered. This particular cancer is delivered. It's across the trusts, and it's really complex, and things break down. And maybe people are too ambitious about how many eligible patients they have and the strength of preference and absence of equipoise. You know, less than a third of trials recruit to schedule. And we know that drug trials are like to be more successful, and trials where the two arms of the trial look the same to the patient are more likely to be successful. And that often isn't the way for a lot of the trials we'll be discussing today. The two arms of the trial can look wildly different. And these are tough trials for inexperienced trialists like surgeons to conduct. So let's be honest about that. So in terms of what I take away from this, and I would really invite comments from more senior and experienced people in the room about how we should move forwards with this. We probably need to improve education and training in head and neck surgery as a specialty. Whether we do it as a workshop, try and gradually shift the culture and introduce videos about recruitment strategies and things like that. Those things have worked in other trials. There is a resource issue. I don't know whether anybody's in the room from the NHS and got a control of these excess treatment costs. I know there is some movement on that front. How do you make trials a priority for these NHS trusts that are almost entirely autonomous? Let's be realistic. In a relatively modestly sized specialty like head and neck surgery, about having trials again that aim to recruit 700, 1,000, 1,200 patients, it's probably just not on. Probably that 400, 450 is probably where we have to be in Britain unless we're going to collaborate internationally. Let's have focus groups to test the randomization on patients and patients and carers groups and find out whether these are basically unacceptable trials right from the outset to the patients. And, you know, this R&D disaster whereby you peer review something 5 times and it goes to R&D and they effectively peer review it again and take 18 months even though they've got no knowledge of the condition, let's just start again and just say, well, look, all we need is a quick tick box is, can you do this trial safely in this unit or not? Have you got the facilities? Because that's really all we need to ask often of an individual unit. And I was going to shut up then. Thank you very much.
Richard, this was a question to Linda, but I think it's equally valid to your excellent talk as well. All said and done, when we look at everything, everybody seems to be doing an awful lot to improve recruitment rates. Do you think that there's an argument for now changing the predicted rate with some sort of formula when we put in terms of methodology for these trials? Or do you think it's just a question that we'll underperform no matter what we set?
Wow. I think some trials do perform to targets. And I think unless you set some sort of ambitious targets, you'll be accused of lack of ambition and you'll not be funded. So there is part of the game is getting a trial through your clinical network group or your clinical studies group and getting somebody like the MRC or CIO on board. And then the reality hits of actually delivering the trial, and they're quite different disciplines. And I do take your point, is that people like me, relative youngsters, will stand up and say, well, you can do this, that, and the other, and it'll be fine. And guess what? We recruit 50% or 70% at best of our targets. And there has been methodology work on why trials and the characteristics of trials that fail to recruit. And I would slightly deflect the question of people with more knowledge on that area, I think.
I just add to that. In my experience as a non-surgeon is that there's an awful lot of distrust of other surgeons. Everybody thinks they can do it, but actually if you give it to someone else, they won't do it as well. And it only works in my hands. I've heard that so many times. And I think a lot of these perceived difficulties within the centres are not really that different. You know, the surgery is actually not as different as people make out. I say that as a non-surgeon, but I suspect it's true.
Those of us on the trial funding bodies discuss this optimistic recruitment rates regularly, and when people say I'll recruit 70% of eligible patients, and I think you raise a good point, because that's too many, and I mean I think it would be well worth looking into more.
Asha. My name is Asha Sinafthi. I'm a surgeon in Portsmouth, and I've been involved in this initiative that Dion's run now for the last 18 months, 2 years. I've thoroughly enjoyed your talk, Richard, and I believe that the main and almost only barrier to recruitment are the surgeons, because they're the people in charge. You can have the best research nurse in the world, the surgeon doesn't want to recruit the patients. And so your talk is particularly important from that point of view, and it also is why there are a maximum number of patients in the place that's running the trial by 100-fold, because that person is interested in the trial and nobody else is. And so it's very key as to how you get buy-in into this and what's in it for me. And I suspect, because it's not going to be money, there's never going to be enough money in the NHS in the UK to pay for patients in all trials. I think it's going to have to be almost a sort of moral thing, that it's unethical to see a patient who is eligible to take part in a well-planned clinical trial and not discuss the trial with them. I think the oncologists have got there, but surgeons haven't.
Very good.
Just a quick one, Richard. Thank you very much. That was wonderful. You mentioned several times the lack of training. Now, the majority of surgeons who are going to be engaged in recruiting are non-academic surgeons. I just want your views about where you see the future. You've highlighted the problem. A handful of academics are going to be passionate about the trials, but the majority of surgeons are going to be there in or out of the trials. So just give us a quick view about how do you think we should handle that issue.
Well, I think we should be able to influence the curriculum for training in surgery. And I guess if you look at some of the best specialties for recruiting, you might look to some of the medical specialties, medical oncology, and how their culture for recruitment is different to ours, and what percentage of a surgical trainee's time is spent on research methodology in general, clinical trials specifically. And I think that should be relatively easy to do, actually. It's a question, and we've got Professor Norman Williams as the president of the Royal College of Surgeons. He'll be pro it, and you know, we've got various people around the room. So I think that's one thing we probably can do. We're not going to do too much about the surgeons who are already over 50, over 55, they're probably not going to change their habits.
Yeah, David O'Reilly, I'm an HPB registrar. Some interesting comments about how important the surgeon is to the recruitment. This notion of equipoise seems to be at the heart of this, and I just wonder if it's actually a slightly wrong concept. It seems to imply that to recruit a patient to a trial, I, as an individual clinician, have to be convinced, you know, somewhere below the clavicles, that the evidence is finely poised between these two ideas. And actually, my uncertainty isn't what the trial's there to resolve. It's there to resolve the uncertainty of the profession. And surely we should feel comfortable recruiting patients to trials if, as a profession, we can agree that we don't have certainty, rather than being about, you know, what I think for myself.
I agree with you, and I also recruit to trials I don't 100% buy into. I only 90% or 95% buy into. I just accept it's for the greater good. But some of our colleagues out there, if they have a feeling that they don't like one arm of the trial, I think that's a big problem.
Yeah, I think that was fascinating, actually, Richard. Really enjoyable talk. But just really to the audience, could I point out that head and neck surgery has come forward leaps and bounds over the last 4 years. You've actually got a response of 75% of your surgeons to your questionnaire. They're engaged. You've got widespread recruitment to your trials across the whole country. There are many surgical disciplines that are leagues away from that. And, you know, if we could get the same level of engagement in other surgical disciplines that you've achieved in head and neck, we would be a long way down the road. So there's a lot of positives in what you've said, and I'm sure you will actually find a solution.
Thank you.
Yes, I think when you speak to patients up and down the country, there's no doubt what is the biggest barrier to recruitment of this trials and indeed any trials. And it is this. I was never asked. Now, this is very... It doesn't stop at that point, you know. Because what it means is also, if they were not asked, it means that they are being discriminated against because they're being denied possibly better treatment. So we're really into a very important section here. And some of the problems lie in the people who are not doing the asking.
I agree with you, and I've been dissuaded from saying this at head and neck meetings, but I'm going to have to start saying that if you're not offering the patient the trials, you shouldn't be seeing the patients. Just send them to somebody who can offer the trials. It doesn't always make you very popular.
One more question.
Thank you. I'm Jenny Gay, plastic surgeon at Guy's and St Thomas's. One thing that I have to detest is that I think saying consultants are the ones that are not signing up is wrong. I actually am part of an international trial, but unfortunately in some clinics, the patients are given a three-minute slot. If you've got a three-minute slot, you cannot possibly, given all the best will in the world, enroll your patient in a trial, even though you know they are eligible. This is a service commitment we're signed up to. So, thankfully, I'm changing my clinics. But that does not mean that other people can do that sort of thing. So I think to label consultants as not being helpful is the wrong thing. I think that is, you know, if you speak to a number of consultants, you'll find their time is limited. So what can they do about it? The other thing is, I totally agree with the patient there, that, yes, if you're not offered, you are being discriminated against. But once again, because of service commitments, the NHS in the UK does not allow you to be asked the question to be involved in trials, because if we sat there and went through every single one that's available, I'm sorry, it's going to take a long time.
Yeah, I mean, the NHS is driving a machine ever faster, producing, surgery, operations, interventions that have no evidence for them, rather than spending 3 minutes to pause for breath to put a patient into a trial so we have evidence in the future. And I think there are other things you can do about your three-minute slot. I've got NHS colleagues that recruit pretty well to trials, and they've had a whole session of their job plan funded by the research network. But you have to recruit first. So basically, your clinic has to run late, or you have to divert the patient out of that clinic into, you know, put them in a Leicester clinic. There are ways of doing it. But the will to do that is from the consultant. And that's where I would take issue with what you said. I think there are pressures on consultants in NHS, but there are ways of resisting those pressures.
Just to reassure you, we're not going to have a panel discussion, so we still will have lunch at 12:30, I'm just sure.
Thank you very much for the invite. I'm speaking today about the CLASS trial on behalf of the CLASS study group. The CLASS trial compares three different treatment options for varicose veins: laser therapy, surgery, and foam sclerotherapy. And it is funded by the HTA, hence this disclaimer. I think it's important to give you some sort of background as to varicose veins, and it'll become relevant later why. But this is a very common condition, which does result in a number of symptoms. But it has to be said that some patients do seek treatment for cosmetic reasons alone. Overall, treatment of varicose veins contributes to considerable workload for vascular surgeons and a considerable cost to the NHS. We do know that patients with varicose veins have significantly impaired quality of life, and we know that treatment is effective in improving this quality of life. A previous HTA RCT, which compared surgery versus conservative therapy, showed quite clearly the benefits of treatment and showed that the cost per quality for treatment was well below the NICE threshold. Since that trial was published, there's been an increasing use of other minimally invasive surgical treatment options, which are even cheaper. They allow greater throughput of patients. They avoid general anaesthetic. And these involve techniques such as foam and laser therapy. It was way back in August 2006 that the HTA recognized the increasing use of foam and put it as a priority area and set out a call for proposals of studies specifically looking into the effect of foam treatment on quality of life. And they stipulated that their primary outcome measure had to be quality of life at 6 months. I'd like to emphasize at this point that foam sclerotherapy uses a sclerosant, which is licensed in an off-license use, so it requires MHRA approval and a CTIMP. When we applied for the grant, we realised there were other techniques that were being used just as regularly as foam, including laser, and we put that into our application. We were fortunate in being funded. So the CLASS trial compares conventional surgery with foam sclerotherapy and endovenous laser therapy, which also allows the use of foam at a later stage if there's still residual varicosities in the calf. The primary objective is, as requested by the HTA, quality of life at 6 months. And this has meant that we need to recruit over 1,000 patients to show a difference between these three arms. So quite a major task in a surgical trial. We're also looking at cost effectiveness. The secondary objectives are shown here: the cost to the health service and the patient, and also technical success. Technical success is interesting because we couldn't have any surgeons buying into the study unless they knew that their technique had been successful, yet the HTA were very reluctant to pay for the duplex scans to be formed to actually prove that the surgery had done what it had to do. But we did manage to push the case, and they agreed to fund it, which meant patients agreed to put patients into the study. And then there's the clinical success, which is residual varicose veins, this well-validated venous clinical severity score, complication rates, and return to normal activities, and behavioural outcomes. And for that, we had to develop a behavioural outcome questionnaire. Our inclusion-exclusion criteria were designed to make this pragmatic study, which would include the vast majority of patients attending the clinics, and are fairly standard. So, eligible patients who are suitable for the three treatment options would be invited to take part in the study, and you can see they'd be randomised either conventional surgery, foam sclerotherapy, or laser with foam sclerotherapy. So three very different arms of the study, and clearly it's not blinded. They're all reviewed at 6 weeks, and in the foam sclerotherapy and the laser groups, they may require additional treatment at that stage because they only have the main trunk treated in the first instance. And then they're all reviewed again at 6 months. And the primary and secondary outcomes are assessed at both 6 weeks and 6 months. We had five original sites, and these were all very experienced sites, many of whom have been involved in previous HTA studies. And due to problems for recruitment, you've guessed, we had to recruit another six sites, which are listed here. So what's our recruitment process? Well, this is what we aim to do at all the sites. When the patient's given an outpatient appointment, we send with the appointment a one-page summary of the study to try and flag it up as soon as possible to the patient. When they get to the clinic, the nurse there is supposed to hand out the patient information leaflet, which comes in two booklets and is well over 20 pages. They're then seen by the surgeon. The study is discussed. Well, we hope the study is discussed, but I'll come back to that later. And it is possible to recruit patients at this stage if the patient so wishes. If they're potentially interested, it's noted on the log, and the patient is then phoned again by the nurse. And again, it is possible to obtain postal consent through a telephone interview, which we have got ethical approval for. So this is all designed to try and flag up the study, make the patients aware of it, and to minimise their inconvenience. On to recruitment. Now, you can see from our original chart there that we were way short of our target recruitment within a few months of starting. And we had spent quite a lot of time, we thought, working out our recruitment targets. We had looked at all the activity in the units. We looked at the proportion of patients who were getting laser. And by definition, we felt that those patients could actually have all three treatments. I rather naively thought that 50% of patients who were eligible would agree, and perhaps that was an overestimate. So we were disappointed to find that we were so short early on with such enthusiastic sites. We revised our recruitment targets based on what was happening at the sites and extended our, applied to the HTA for a costed extension. So we went from an 18-month recruitment to another additional 12 months on top of that. And this is our recruitment figures to date. And we're doing a bit better, so perhaps our revised targets were more realistic. But there are a number of things which have affected those targets, which I will discuss. These include the time taken to establish new sites, and I don't want to do too much R&D bashing. I know that every other speaker has mentioned it, but I'm afraid I'm going to do it too. Rationing by PCTs for this non-life-threatening condition, and variation in proportion of patients eligible at the sites, which is also affected by rationing or non-rationing, as we'll see. And then there's the patient centre and surgeon preferences. So the median time for R&D approval was 4 months, and some of them were very good, as you can see from this slide. Unfortunately, the ones that were slow, actually, including one of them, which was just about 8 months, is our second highest recruitment centre. So for 8 months, we couldn't get this enthusiastic site on board, and that was very frustrating. And that site has also suffered by having problems with their UKCRN funding with their nurse, which has now been resolved. We've also seen considerable changes in the PCT's referral practice. You recall I said we looked at all the activity at the sites when we were doing our power calculation and assessing the time taken for recruitment. Well, when we started the study, we found that we'd had a huge shortfall at that stage alone in the number of patients actually being referred. And if we look at the two bottom ones here, Leeds and Exeter, ignore Aberdeen for the moment, we'll see that there's been even further fall off in referrals since the study started. So Leeds has gone from 150 patients per quarter down to 50 over this timescale. Exeter also have had a considerable decrease, and this is reflected in all the sites. Aberdeen, in our only Scottish site, is not being particularly affected by the PCTs or the referral practice. And indeed, in our site, we actually thought we had an increased number of referrals of patients who wanted this minimally invasive techniques that we were offering. So we haven't been particularly affected by any rationing. When the patients come to the clinics, we do our best, and there are difficulties at various sites, to look at the total number of patients being referred to the clinic and look at the reasons why they're not eligible, just to see how generalizable our criteria are. We found that 48% of screened patients are actually eligible for the study, which is good news. But we've also shown that there's considerable variation in the case mix going to the various centres, and there may well be, I suspect, a different application of eligibility criteria. although that's difficult to prove. If we look at the non-eligible patients, the main reason why they're not eligible is because they don't have varicose veins, or they have no reflux in the veins we want to treat. And it's fair to say that there's big variation in those ranges, from hardly any of the patients having those non-eligibility criteria to up to 38%. And in Aberdeen, where we have no rationing, we actually have a much higher proportion of patients who do not have varicose veins or reflux. And this has led my clinical lead to revise our guidelines to our GPs in our area. So it has had an effect on our referral practice and will do in the future. The recurrence does vary a lot between sites, but there's only one site that has a very high recurrence rate. The rest are fairly static. So it's interesting to see the differences in referral practice at these various clinics. I'm afraid we've already discussed this, and this is by far one of the biggest problems I have with this, with recruiting patients at the various sites. Everybody says they're keen to recruit, but you can see there's a huge variation in who is actually recruiting. So this shows the proportion of eligible patients who agree to take part in class by surgeon at three sites. And look at site number three. We have less than 3% of patients being recruited by one surgeon and over 55% by another. Again, showing the variation in buy-in to this study amongst surgeons. Overall, only 24% of eligible patients agreed to take part in this study. If we look at what happens to the patients who don't agree to take part, well, it's quite interesting. This is our five original sites, and we can see at site one, those who don't agree to take part but who are eligible tend to go for foam, whereas site two and four, they tend to go for surgery, which is the top line, and three and five, they tend to go for laser. I found this particularly interesting because when we set up the study, there was a lot of debate as to whether patients would agree to take part because they would not want, it was felt, to undergo invasive surgery, and they'd want to have them in invasive treatment options. But here we have two of the sites where patients are clearly getting surgery rather than going into the study. It's difficult to say whether these are patient or centre preferences, but I suspect they are centre rather than patient preferences. To take this further forward, in one of the centres, Jane, Jenny and Sangeesh have done a sub-study to look at the interviews and also to interview the patient afterwards. So these are audio-recorded recruitment consultations involving consultants only, because in vascular surgery, we have become a very consultant-led specialty, so we're very lucky if we have any trainees at all at our clinics, particularly varicose vein clinics. So the audio recorder would go on, and the surgeon was given the way to present their normal consultation. And interpretation of the consultations by the research team has shown that there was a fairly balanced presentation of treatment options by the surgeons, but for some reason the surgeons at this site assumed that the patient had a preference for treatment and asked the patient to take part in the study if they didn't have a preference, rather than saying please take part in the study up front, which is somewhat interesting. I have to say not all patients, despite the fact that despite the fact the tape recorder was put on, actually remembered to discuss the study. So obviously they were having a bit of a rushed, bad day. But when the patients were interviewed later by the team, many did not express a clear preference and actually after the consultation felt obliged to express a preference. So they were unlikely to go into the study. So this has really been quite an eye-opener for me, and congratulate Jane and team on Jenny on a very good sub-study. As a result of this, we felt that despite our surgeons being experienced and taking part in previous studies, that we should perhaps devise a crib sheet to try and help them, perhaps what they could say to the patient by introducing the study, and disseminate this amongst the sites, go and do site visits again, and see if it has any effect on recruitment. So we'll wait to see. So in summary, there have been problems in recruitment in class, like the other studies, but we have almost 600 patients to date recruited. There have been reduction in referrals of types of patients by PCTs out with our control. There's varying surge in enthusiasm. We may think that there's equipoise between the centres on treatment received by what eligible patients who decline actually end up having. And the patient reasons for non-participation, I think, require further evaluation. Thank you very much for your time.
Hi, thank you for your talk. I'm Anna Schilder. I'm an ENT surgeon and a trialist, and I'm here in the UK to set up a program for trials in ENT. And I've done several trials in the Netherlands, and what I've missed in your talks, but also of the others, is the role of the GPs in, you know, recruiting patients for the trial. I mean, in some of the more complicated conditions, of course, they're not simply referred by GPs, but when it is about common conditions, have you ever thought about informing GPs about the study, and, you know, so they can hand out information sheets already in the practice?
We did, and we had a big debate about this. The problem is that in England, not in Scotland, there's a book and choose system, so mm-hmm. patients can choose where they want to go for their treatment. It was felt that some centres would be accused of canvassing patients if they took part in the study and other centres didn't. And there was a huge dilemma about approaching GPs. And then there was the cost issue and the fact that they're rationing it. So I'm afraid we felt it was too complicated to pursue that in the UK.
But I'm sure it must be a route to improve recruitment, I think, in the future. I'm sure there must be another solution to that.
Thank you.
Yes, on the question of centre recruitment, we have, among other things, quite a serious geographical problem. We have centres which refuse to either give financial or practical help to trials. And really, you know, they're acting in a parasitic way because they want to benefit from the trials, but they don't want to contribute to them. And so I would like to suggest a solution that should be considered for this, and that is those centres that refuse to join into the real world, they should have to pay a levy, whether they're taking part or not. This would help them to sort of join the real world, and it would also help to readjust the geographical balance.
I take your point, but I think the major problem of recruitment is actually the surgeons at the centres, not the actual trusts.
Well, they could pay the levy to the centres that are recruiting. That could help. Okay, we will move on because of time. And our last speaker this morning is a surgical trainee, one of those creatures we were talking about earlier. I'm very pleased to have Tom here in his final year of training. And we are going to hear from Tom about a bottom-up approach to actually try and change the culture to get surgeons involved in trials. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much. I'm here presenting on behalf of the Westmans Research Collaborative about the whole idea of training-led research. In so doing, I need to give a brief background as to why we formed and how we formed, talk a bit about our progress over the last 3 or 4 years, and then mention the Rossini trial only very superficially as a demonstration of how it can work. More interestingly for today is really why it works and where it's going, in our opinion. We formed in 2007 at a national conference, one of those annual conferences where we're standing around a group from the West Midlands looking at our posters and our oral presentations, thinking that they're all quite good ideas, but realising they were never going to go much further. They wouldn't get published, and they wouldn't change practice, simply because they had small numbers, and they tended to never be carried on. I'm sure most people here would recognise that as a problem. It was a very simple idea, just to use the fact that we were all in different hospitals, and if we did a coordinated and homogenous bit of research, very simple research at the same time across different units, we would suddenly get a multi-centre trial that was really quite good and quite impressive. And it was taking advantage of this natural network, and in the West Midlands and in all surgical deaneries, registrars rotate normally over 6 to 12 month rotations. There's a multitude of benefits from this. From the research point of view, as we've already mentioned, you're going to have multi-centre trials on a plate. They're going to recruit a lot better by using the collective drive of all of the people involved. And clinical surgical trials, as we all know, are quite difficult to run. This is a way of really getting them produced. The trainees' point of view, the ones in red are obvious, and really they are the carrot that draws people in. The ones in black are a little bit more subtle and obtuse, and they certainly are becoming more apparent as time goes on, the other skills. I think the region does benefit. It has some reflected glory from the collaborative to some extent. It has the research throughput of the region certainly increases, and ultimately patients will benefit from all of this. We started off doing multi-centre cohort retrospective studies with CHARMS and CANOES were the first two. We had a C. diff study with about 8,000 patients from 7 different hospitals, which is the largest one in the world, which is just being written up at the moment. And then CANOES looked at breast cancer ethnicity. We used the West Midlands very ethnically diverse population to look at various aspects, including the outcomes. Again, that was very large and is just being written up at the moment. It's had some presentations accepted for that. We then moved across to Rossini, which is what I'm going to discuss on the next slide. We had some... Rossini is coming towards the end of its life, as we'll see. We've got some more RCTs in the pipeline. DREAMS has BDRF funding, has ethical approval, and its portfolio status has been granted. That's just had its pilot phase and is being rolled out to more centres. And ROX is a hernia study looking into biological mesh prevention of hernia after stomocyte closure. That's just going through its first pilot phases and ethics. We've since, in parallel, done some more cohort studies, including Gorsa pancreatitis one and a few other ones that aren't listed here. You can judge progress in various ways. To me, the most important one is that we've got about 70 people trained for GCP that I think wouldn't have otherwise been trained. These are trainees, about 45 or 50 in the West Midlands and the remainder nationally. On top of that, there are more junior trainees involved in surgical research, which I'll come back onto. In terms of money, we've got about £500,000 through the collaborative for the three RCTs. Papers, presentations and meetings are evolving. We've had our first major presentation, first major publication accepted recently. So Rossini, very briefly, it was the first RCT we set up. It was deliberately as simple as we could possibly make it, a one intervention trial. It's looking at using a wound guard, a wound edge protection device in people having a laparotomy. That's a very low-resolution picture of a wound guard, just so we all know what we're talking about. It's a plastic ring inside the abdomen to which this impervious sheet is attached. You open it out, and you do the laparotomy through it. It's a fairly cheap bit of kit. It costs about £16. We were deliberately as inclusive as we could, so any patient having any laparotomy for any indication through any incision is eligible for the trial. The only exclusion is laparoscopic surgery if you're under 18 or you can't consent. We have online randomization, one-to-one control to intervention. That's done whilst the patient's in the anaesthetic room. And then we have blinded wound reviews before the patient goes home on about day 5 to day 7. And then they have to come back for a wound review at about 30 days. The interim period is covered by a self-reported questionnaire, which is collected at the 30-day follow-up. We're going to lengths to collect good quality of life and resource usage data as well. If this is going to change practice, we need to have some financial figures attached to it. As I mentioned, we are funded by the RFPB grant. In terms of the sites, the ones on the left are in the West Midlands, which is where this thing started, and the ones on the right are national. And I've noticed that there are more national ones than there are West Midlands ones now. The West Midlands ones came from our own members going to speak to their bosses about this and it rolling out from there. The national ones came at first from people we met in the pub, friends of friends, people at conferences, again, rolling it out. And then more recently, some of the ones lower down have come from the fact this is a portfolio trial and getting it through the hub. This is our recruitment graph, and it's a bit complicated, so I apologise for that. On the right-hand side, we have the sites. The blue bars were our predicted sites. We allowed for 19 sites. You can see we're up to 21 sites at the moment, and we've got another 5 in the pipeline, as you saw from the previous slide. And we had a really interest of sites here, so we really opened sites early on, which was great. The left-hand axis is the recruitment arm. The blue is the predicted, and the orange is our actual. So we're running about 2 to 2.5 months ahead of schedule. Our predicted British recruitment is there, and we were due to finish next March, and we're going to finish in about December time, we think. That's a fairly conservative estimate, given we've got more sites opening, two in the next couple of weeks as well. And it's fair to say it's something that we're pretty thrilled with. I just want to give a brief overview of really how the ideal site works, and this is the way it works in a few of the sites. Some of them are less inclusive than this. At the pre-op assessment clinic, the house officer will give the patient the information sheet. So everyone has an elective laparotomy. We'll come to a pre-op assessment normally the week before. Every new house of house officers, the local lead investigator, which is the registrar, will sit down with the house officers, tell them about the study, give them the information leaflet, give them a demonstration device, which is kept in the pre-op assessment room. And then the house officers go off and talk to patients about it, and they really enjoy it. They always say it's a nice change from the monotony of clerking patients and writing notes. And that means when the patient comes back the following week for their operation, they already have had the leaflet and they know what the trial is all about. And the majority will then consent to the trial on the morning of surgery at the same time as they sign their confirmation of consent for their normal operation. That's done by the registrar, sometimes a senior SHO or the consultant. They're randomised while the patient's asleep or going to sleep, normally by the operating registrar or consultant sometimes. And then in terms of the follow-up, the wound review on the ward is done by a variety of people in different centres, as long as they can recognise a wound infection and we have a record of everyone who's assessing wounds, then it'll be an SHO, sometimes a house officer, clinical nurse specialist, stoma nurse, ward sister or research nurses. The follow-up review, the hardest part of the whole trial is arranging that review and making sure patients come back for it, and that's really an interaction between the house officer who's doing the discharge summary, the booking clerk for outpatients or for the pre-op assessment or wherever the patient comes back to. Some units it's the ward, some it's the pre-op assessment, some it's the clinic itself. And then it's undertaken by similar people to the one who did the inpatient wound review. We've had a think about why it's recruiting well. The top two criteria I think are a major factor. It's very simple. We've got deliberately broad inclusion criteria, so everyone who comes through the door pretty much can be included in the trial. I should have mentioned this is also open to emergency laparotomies. In our first 100 patients, half the patients were emergencies as well. So it's not just elective patients. We were conscious that we didn't want the house officer or the local registrar to have to look through a big list of exclusion criteria. It's certainly a sexy topic. We came along at just the right time. SSI, wound infection, is something that's quite measurable to a degree. And in the age of revalidation and payment by results and league tables, it's something that everyone's interested in reducing. The trainee buy-in, the fact that this is entirely designed, ran all the applications and grant went through trainees and the trial management group is run by trainees, certainly helps this sense of ownership. And I'd be naive to think that the fact that it's a portfolio trial isn't a major factor in its recruitment as well. Other things leading to success is I think an authorship policy that you stick to, you set out at the beginning and then you stick with, is very important. We haven't finished this trial yet. But we do know every patient that's been, who's randomised them, who's done the wound reviews, which consultant was in charge of their care, and they will be accredited on the end result. We've had some incentives for high recruitment, so a case of wine to the next to the site that recruits the most by Christmas, that kind of thing, and it's worked. We also people are busy. Remember, everyone doing this trial is a normal trainee in a normal job. No one's doing this research out of programme. So every Friday they get a reminder of who's in the trial, what review needs doing and when, and which ones are overdue. And we do newsletters about once every 2 months with the graph on it, which keeps everyone's spirits up. Just taking a small step back, this is part of the wider research collaborative. So we have meetings once a month, and these meetings are predictable. The first Monday of each month, we have education to really keep people engaged in this and all the other trials we run with journal clubs and getting expert speakers from other areas to come. It's very inclusive and open. We have house officers coming. It's not just surgical registrars, house officers visiting clinical observers from overseas. And we try and have someone from the trials unit most days as well to give some immediate stats advice about new ideas. The committee has a regular turnover to keep it fresh and stop it from being too much of a hierarchical system. And we welcome new studies. Probably every other month we talk about another new study, some of which we'll go on to do fairly quickly afterwards. I think taking a further step back and talking about really one of today's aims, we've seen that trainees can run their own trials, and that will increase the trials body, and it will indirectly make other people do better surgical trials. But I think one of the areas that's quite interesting for me is really getting involved in RCTs that aren't belonging to the trainees. was mentioned on the first presentation, the rescue ICP using registrars. And I think, I apologise, these are all colorectal trials, but it's what I know. The CREST trial is a colorectal stenting trial for emergency patients presenting with large bowel obstruction. They tend to come in, or they can come in the middle of the night or over a long bank holiday weekend. If the trainees are aware of these trials, because they're becoming research savvy, you'll increase your recruitment no end. The other trials are in a more elective kind of setting. If you're an outpatient seeing someone with a fistula or with recurrent admissions from problems with radiotherapy to the small bowel, you may, if you're aware of these other trials, you may even introduce your boss to them and get them to refer across to someone who does these trials or to become involved in them. It's not all plain sailing. The trials are led and designed by trainees, but they can't all be designed by all the trainees, especially when you've got people doing it across the country. So we do our best to maintain a sense of inclusivity, having large trial steering group meetings, getting everyone involved, assigning jobs, and really getting them to bring their own trials. And then it's a sense that if they'll help with ours, we'll help with theirs, and vice versa. The consultants in the West Midlands were at first a little bit sceptical, I think is the word. They've become more and more on board, and we now present every 6 months at our West Midlands Surgical Society and give them updates as to where we're going and how we're doing. Certainly once we got the RFPB funding and a trial manager for Rossini, they started taking us a bit more seriously. You'll notice if you're eagle-eyed on the graph, October, November was a big dip in Rossini recruitment, or a relatively big dip, and that's something that we are anticipating this October and for our other trials that are just opening. The very secret to success is rotation through hospitals, but that's also an Achilles heel. When everyone moves, everything changes. The local people may not have GCP, the local systems will be different. So that's something that we're working on hard to try and stop that happening so badly this year. A really interesting area, which I just want to mention towards the end, is the other collaboratives that have followed our West Midlands example. The London group are probably the most advanced, following on from us. They've got their launch meeting next Wednesday, which that's their very fancy flyer. There are some members, there's Rina in the middle of the room, who's on the London committee. And if anyone's London trainees or London trialists or surgeons, they'd be more than happy to welcome you to that meeting next Wednesday night. They've got some very eminent speakers. Going back to the other ones, there's a Bristol group which is getting off the ground, a Mersey group which is also doing very well, and then three others that are in their infancy. As someone alluded to earlier, I think Dion alluded to, the cardiothoracic trainees are establishing a national one because of their lower numbers, and even the orthopods are following on as well. We organise national meetings, so our first one was in 2009. This is national to try and get other people from other regions to come to the West Midlands and really to start their own collaboratives, and it seems to be working, as you've seen. We get big-name speakers to come and talk about trials, give updates on clinical trials, and we get these BJS new project presentations. So people bring their ideas from all around the country. We select the best four as a proposal for a new trial. The winner gets £250 from kind sponsorship from the BJS, and then so far two of those have been taken on as new studies. The one for this year is the 14th of December. That's a bit of an advert for it, but please do come. It's free. It's in a nice hotel in Birmingham. See me or one of the other collaborative members. I can give you some more information. There's our contact details. If I may summarise, trainee-led research works and is working. It's attractive to the registrars and it's attractive to the trials community. It is, however, very underutilised at the moment. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. Really encouraging, brilliant. I know Dion's supported it extensively. Some quick questions.
I think that's absolutely brilliant. can you tell me, how does this sort of fit in with the other academic training that you do, like people who do MDs and PhDs? Is that something that you incorporate, or is it run separately? Or
At the moment, it's entirely separate. This is purely clinical research that's done in parallel to their normal job, their normal on-calls, their normal rotation. Some people obviously will go off and do that, but there's no direct link between any of our stuff and MDs or PhDs at the moment.
Tom, David Beard from Oxford. Tom, as a trainee, we use trainees a lot in Oxford in our trials, but how do you, just a question for you, and probably for the other surgeons in the room, how do you feel about trainees being in trials and performing technically challenging operations? Do you think that might be a confounder if
these trials are trainee-led?
I think the fact that the trial is designed and ran and coordinated by the trainees shouldn't have any impact at all on the clinical outcome of the patient or the operation. They're still not going to be doing anything themselves that they wouldn't be doing otherwise as part of their what's suitable for their seniority. So I don't think it has any impact in terms of the way things should be run on an individual patient basis, no.
Justin Vale from Imperial. I think it's fantastic and very uplifting, but you had the slide about, you had the one line about authorship policy, and yet you say the big motivator when you set this up was around CVs, obviously, and publications. How have you done your authorship policy?
We sat down as a steering group at the beginning of each trial and work out who we're going to accredit. For Rossini, it's every consultant whose patients put into the trial to get them involved. Everyone who puts a patient into the trial themselves, and we know that from the consent form, who's the investigator. Obviously, they're GCP trained as well, but we know from each individual form that comes back to the trials unit who's been doing what at each centre, and anyone who performs a wound review. And that's what we've set out, and that's what we plan to stick with. Obviously, at the moment, that means Rossini's got about 94 authors we've worked out from the people who've done the various different things. And that'll be assessed as our normal presentation when we go around to the regional training days or to individual units and really sell the trial. We have a demonstration set of slides using a Lancet SIGAR trial, or the FlexiScope trial actually, which has 8 names at the top on behalf of the Flexible Sigmoidoscopy Research Group, and then about 150 names at the bottom in various descriptions, histopathologists, coordinators, surgeons. That's exactly what we plan to do for this trial.
We need lots of carrots and it will be money, as we said.
So. Nigel Hall, I'm a paediatric surgical trainee in London. Congratulations on setting this up. I've recently started the process of setting up a similar network amongst paediatric surgical trainees, and because of the size of our specialty, it's nationwide, not region-specific. The response has been enormous. And I think the key issue that you highlight is the carrot. People are interested in doing this if there's something in it for them. For trainees, it's clearly the name on a paper or the benefit of getting something else out of it in terms of building their CV. And I suspect for a lot of the surgeons that are involved at the consultant level, there isn't a carrot in them. The converted who are sitting in this room do it for their interest or for the greater good, but for the majority of surgeons out there in the community, there is no carrot in them, hence why they don't recruit. One question for you is, have you had any problems about getting consultants in your centres involved in running the research in the various centres, given that the approach comes from trainees, and how have you gone about dealing with that?
A couple of surgeons, I mean, I was going to answer to Linda's statement earlier about whether trainees can go to consultants with a project, and I think absolutely they can. If it's done in the right way, we have one-page summaries of all our trials, and then they can nobble them whilst they're sat in the coffee room in theatre and just discuss the trial with them at that stage. We have formal PowerPoint presentations. And if it's presented with a background, ideally a forest plot of the available evidence at the moment, saying that there is really equipoise, we don't know, the majority of surgeons will buy into that. We sell the fact they're not going to have to do very much for it, and I think that is a selling point. You know, most of the donkey work will be done by the registrars with some help from the local R&D people. But we've had a few surgeons who won't participate in Rossini because they say they don't have equipoise either way. But in those units, we then are a bit tenacious, and we've got one site where of the 8 consultants, 7 will put their patients in and 1 won't. That's fine. We just don't put theirs in.
Hello, Sheila Fisher, ex-maxillofacial surgeon, and now working in patient and public involvement with NCRI and NCRN. So it's from that latter perspective I'm going to ask my question. And I thought your slide, your ideal pathway, really does unblock quite a lot of the problems we face in recruitment. So I'd just like to sort of think about that slide for a moment. And also, if we go back to the first presentation, the thing that you've both done is you've taken awareness of the study to the patient at a time that fits admirably with their normal pathway. So they're making research decisions as part of their normal care. And I think if we're unblocking the sort of patient end of it, we really shouldn't underestimate the importance of research being part of normal care and part of the normal discussion. And I think you did it admirably, so
thank you.
Well done.
Yes, hear to that one. And the last question somewhere at the back.
Yeah, hi. Mad Sides from the MRC Clinical Trials Unit. I think it's excellent that you've set this up. As a statistician who works in a clinical trials unit, who's tried to engage with surgeons in the past with mixed degrees of success, I'm delighted to see this bottom-up approach of young surgeons coming through who are clearly research-oriented and research-savvy. Picky question, what happens when you stop being a trainee, and how do you think the how do you think your interactions will change?
I don't know yet. You're right. I mean, I think the Mr. Shaw's presentation about changing the head and neck surgeons, I think changing consultants' opinions won't happen, or will happen with great difficulty. If you get the trainees, in 5 years' time, you've suddenly got a research-savvy consultant body. I would hope this is happening in parallel to changes in consultant contracts and in the way academic research in surgery or clinical research in surgery is performed, and that we'll see a new breed of junior surgical consultants who have a great research interest and research ability. That they will have designed, ran, and led, you know, these high-quality trials, so they'll be in a great position to actually do the same thing as a consultant. But you're right, there is a great unknown, which we'll find out in the next few years.
Thank you. That's a great place to stop. What a vision for the next 5-10 years. Thank you very much. So we're going to have 45 minutes break now for lunch. We'll reconvene at 1:30, and lunch is where you had coffee. Can I just ask the speakers to... just come forward, because we want to do some photographs, sorry, before you have lunch. Just the speakers. Sorry, we have a lunch. We need to do some advertising. So, someone here. We need to put it in all the news. Thank you.
they don't have the opportunity for private work, nor do they need to go to the car showroom.
Also, yeah, they're looking for a suspect.
Exactly, does it target?
Somebody getting involved with their MD made it so much their ownership that people got to be sick of that.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. That's what
would happen. Undermine the collaboration.
I should think
that you can pick up that this. If you have to work with Tom, and that's an error, then they can send it around the unit. And if you don't mind me saying, I didn't.
So the only advantage and disadvantage of what we've got in the free room
Thank you.